Flaming steel particles were launched into the air as more than 100,000 artillery rounds exploded over the next 4 hours. Everything burned. Even the most respectable citizens were now penniless refugees, their homes smoldering ruins, and Confederate money now mere scraps of paper. The dead and dying were everywhere, fell by the random whistling shells. The air smelled of wood smoke, gunpowder, and burning flesh. Hundreds of citizens lost their lives on that terrible night. Richmond was a proud city and perhaps more distinctly American than even Washington, D.C. It could even be said that the United States of America was born in Richmond, for it was there in 1775 in Richmond's St. John's Episcopal Church that Patrick Henry looked out on a congregation that included George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and delivered the famous "Give me liberty or give me death" speech, which fomented American rebellion, the Revolutionary War, and independence itself. As the capital of Virginia since 1780, it was where Jefferson had served as governor. He'd also designed its capitol building. It was in Richmond that Jefferson and James Madison crafted the statute separating church and state that would later inform the First Amendment of the Constitution. And now, Richmond was devastated by its own sons. Soldiers of the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia sowed landmines in their wake as they abandoned the city. Such was their haste that they forgot to remove the small rows of red flags denoting the narrow but safe pass through the minefield, a mistake that saved hundreds of Union lives as soldiers entered the city. Richmond was still in flames on the morning of April 3rd when the Union troops, following those red flags, arrived. Brick facades and chimneys still stood, but wooden frames and roofs had been incinerated. The barbarous South had consigned it to flames, one Union officer wrote of Richmond, and even after a night of explosions, the roar of bursting shells was terrific. Smoldering ruins and the sporadic whistle of artillery greeted the 24th and 25th regiments of the Union Army. The instant the long blue line marched into town, the slaves of Richmond were free. They were stunned to see that the 25th contained black soldiers from a new branch of the Army known as the USCT, the United States Colored Troops. Lieutenant Johnston Livingston DePeyster, a member of General Wetzel's staff, galloped his horse straight into the Capitol building. "I sprang from my horse," he wrote proudly, "and rushed up onto the roof." In his hand was an American flag. Dashing to the flagpole, he hoisted the Stars and Stripes over Richmond. The Capitol was Confederate no more. That particular flag was poignant for two reasons. It had 36 stars, a new number owing to Nevada's recent admission to the Union. Per tradition, this new flag would not become official until the 4th of July. It was the flag of the America to come, the post-war America, united and expanding. It was, in other words, the flag of Abraham Lincoln's dreams. So it is fitting when 11 short days later, a 36-star flag will be folded into a pillow and placed beneath Abraham Lincoln's head after a gunman puts a bullet into his brain. But for now, President Lincoln is alive and well, walking the ruined streets of the conquered Confederate capital. Chapter 7, Tuesday, April 4th, 1865, Richmond, Virginia. Abraham Lincoln has never fought in a battle. During his short 3-month enlistment during the Black Hawk War in 1832, he was somewhat oddly both a captain and a private, but never a fighter. He is a politician, and politicians are seldom given the chance to play the role of conquering hero. It could be said that General Grant deserved the honor more than President Lincoln, for it was his strategy and concentrated movements of manpower that brought down the Confederate government. But it is Lincoln's war. It always has been. To Lincoln goes the honor of conquering hero and the hatred of those who have been conquered. No one knows this more than the freed slaves of Richmond. They throng to Lincoln's side, so alarming the sailors who rowed him ashore that they form a protective ring around the president, using their bayonets to push the slaves away. The sailors maintain this ring around Lincoln as he marches through the city, even as his admiring entourage grows from mere dozens to hundreds. The white citizens of Richmond, tight-lipped and hollow-eyed, take it all in. Abraham Lincoln is their enemy no more. As the citizens of Petersburg came to realize yesterday, he is something even more despicable, their president. These people never thought they'd see the day Abraham Lincoln would be strolling down the streets of Richmond as if it were his home. They make no move, no gesture, no cry, no sound to welcome him. Every window was crowded with heads, one sailor will remember, but it was a silent crowd. There was something oppressive in those thousands of watchers without a sound, either of welcome or hatred. I think we would have welcomed a yell of defiance. Lincoln's extraordinary height means that he towers over the crowd, providing an ideal moment for an outraged Southerner to make an attempt on his life. But no one takes a shot. No drunken, saddened, addled, enraged citizens of Richmond so much as attacks Lincoln with their fists. Instead, Lincoln receives the jubilant welcome of former slaves reveling in their first moments of freedom. The president keeps walking until he is a mile from the wharf. Soon Lincoln finds himself on the corner of 12th and Clay Streets, staring at the former home of Jefferson Davis. When first built in 1818, the house was owned by the president of the Bank of Virginia, John Brockenbrough. But Brockenbrough is now long dead. A merchant by the name of Lewis Crenshaw owned the property when war broke out. He had just added a third floor and redecorated the interior with all the modern conveniences, including gas lights and a flush toilet, when he was persuaded to sell it, furnished to Richmond authorities for the generous sum of $43,000, in Confederate dollars, of course. The authorities, in turn, rented it to the Confederate government, which was in need of an executive mansion. It was August 1861 when Jefferson Davis, his much younger second wife Verena, and their three young children moved in. Now they have all fled, and Lincoln steps past the sentry boxes, grasps the wrought iron railing, and marches up the steps into the Confederate White House. He is shown into a small room with floor-to-ceiling windows and crossed cavalry swords over the door. "This was President Davis's office," a housekeeper says respectfully. Lincoln's eyes roam over the elegant dark wood desk, which Davis had so thoughtfully tidied before running off 2 days earlier. "Then this must be President Davis's chair," he says with a grin, sinking into its burgundy padding. He crosses his legs and leans back. That's when the weight of the moment hits him. Lincoln asks for a glass of water, which is promptly delivered by Davis's former butler, a slave, along with a bottle of whiskey. Where Davis has gone, Lincoln does not know. He has no plans to hunt him down. Reunification, however painful it might be to Southerners, is within Lincoln's grasp. There will be no manhunt for the Confederate president, nor a trial for war crimes. As for the people of Richmond, many of whom actively conspired against Lincoln and the United States, the president has ordered that the Union Army command the citizenry with a gentle hand, or in Lincoln's typically folksy parlance, let him up easy. He can afford to relax. Lincoln has Richmond. The Confederacy is doomed. All the president needs now is for Grant to finish the rest of the job, and then he can get to work. Lincoln still has miles to go before he sleeps. Chapter 8, Wednesday, April 5th, 1865. Amelia Courthouse, Virginia, noon to midnight. Wave after wave of retreating Confederate soldiers arrive in Amelia Courthouse throughout the day of April 4th. They have marched long and hard, yanked forward on an invisible rope by the promise of a long sleep and a full belly. But it was a lie, a broken promise, a nightmare all at once. Without food, they have no hope. Like the sailors who quit the march from Richmond because their feet hurt, many Confederate soldiers now find their own way to surrender. Saying they are going into the woods to hunt for dinner, they simply walk away from the war. And they keep on walking until they reach their homes weeks and months later, or lie down and die as they desert, too weak to take another step. Lee's optimism has been replaced by the heavy pall of defeat. His face was still calm as it always was, wrote one enlisted man, but his carriage was no longer erect, as his soldiers had been used to seeing it. The trouble of these last days had already plowed great furrows in his forehead. His eyes were red as if from weeping, his cheeks sunken and haggard, his face colorless. No one who looked upon him, as he stood there in full view of the disastrous end, can ever forget the intense agony written on his features. Lee's hope rests on forage wagons now out scouring the countryside in search of food. He anxiously awaits their return, praying they will be overflowing with grains and smoked meats and leading calves and pigs to be slaughtered. The wagons come back empty. The countryside is bare. There are no rations for Lee and his men. The soldiers become frantic, eating anything they could find. Cow hooves, tree bark, rancid raw bacon, and hog and cattle feed. Some have taken to secreting pack horses or mules away from the main group and quietly slaughtering and eating them. Making matters even worse, word now reaches Lee that Union cavalry intercepted a column of supply wagons that raced out of Richmond just before the fall. The wagons were burned and the Teamsters taken prisoner. Lee and his army are in the great noose of Grant's making, which is squeezing tighter and tighter with every passing hour. Lee must move before Grant finds him. His fallback plan is yet another forced march, this one to the city of Danville, where more than a million rations allegedly await. Danville, however, is 100 miles south. As impossible as it is to think of marching an army that far on empty stomachs, it is Lee's only hope. Lee could surrender right there and then, but it isn't in his character. He's willing to demand incredible sacrifice to avoid the disgrace of defeat. A cold rain falls on the morning of April 5th. Lee gives an order to move out. It is in the minds of one Confederate, the cruelest marching order the commanders had ever given the men in 4 years of fighting. Units of infantry, cavalry, and artillery begin slogging down the road. Danville is a four-day march, if they have the energy to make it. It is now, one soldier writes in his diary, a race of life and death. They get only 7 miles before coming to a dead halt at a Union roadblock outside of Jetersville. At first, it appears to be no more than a small cavalry force, but a quick look through Lee's field glasses tells him differently. Soldiers are digging trenches and fortifications along the road, building the berms and breastworks that will protect them from rebel bullets, and then fortifying them with fallen trees and fence rails. Lee gallops Traveler to the front and assesses the situation. Part of him wants to make a bold statement by charging into the Union works in a last grand suicidal hurrah. But Lee's army has followed him so loyally because of not only his brilliance, but also his discretion. Sometimes knowing when not to fight is just as important to a general's success as knowing how to fight. And this is not the time to engage. Lee quickly swings his army west in a grand loop toward the town of Painville. The men don't travel down one single road, but follow a series of parallel arteries connecting the hamlets and burgs of rural Virginia. The countryside is rolling and open in some places, in some forested, and in others swampy. Creeks and rivers overflowing their banks in the recent rains drench the troops at every crossing. On any other day, the Army of Northern Virginia might not have minded, but with so many miles to march, soaking shoes and socks will eventually mean the further agony of walking on blistered, frozen feet. The topography favors an army lying in wait, ready to spring a surprise attack. But they are an army in flight, at the mercy of any force hidden in the woods. And indeed, Union cavalry repeatedly harassed the rear of Lee's exhausted column. The horsemen are not bold or dumb enough to attack Lee's main force, which outnumbers them by thousands. Instead, they attack the defenseless supply wagons in a series of lightning-quick charges. On narrow, swampy roads, the Union cavalry burned more than 200 Confederate supply wagons, capture 11 battle flags, and take more than 600 prisoners, spreading confusion and panic. Sensing disaster, Lee springs to the offensive, ordering cavalry under the command of his nephew, Major General Fitzhugh Lee, and Major General Thomas Rosser, to catch and kill the Union cavalry before they can gallop back to the safety of their Jetersville line. In the running battle that follows, rebel cavalry kill 30 and wound another 150 near the resort town of Amelia Springs. If the Union needs proof that there is still fight in Lee's army, it now has it. Lee marches his men all day, and then all night. At a time when every fiber of their beings cries out for sleep and food, they press forward over muddy, rutted roads, enduring rain and chill, and the constant harassment of the Union cavalry. The roads are shoulder to shoulder with exhausted men, starving pack animals, and wagons sinking up to their axles in thick Virginia mud. Dead and dying mules and horses are shoved to the side of the road so as not to slow the march. Dead men litter the ground, too, and are just as quickly tossed to the shoulder or merely stepped over. There's no time for proper burials. Nothing can slow the march to Danville. Men drop their bedrolls because they lack the strength to carry them. Many more thrust their guns, bayonet first, into the earth and leave them behind. On the rare occasions when the army stops for rest, men simply crumple to the ground and sleep. When it's time to march again, officers move from man to man, shaking them awake and ordering them to their feet. Some men refuse to rise and are left sleeping, soon to become Union prisoners. Others can't rise because they're simply too weak. In the early phases of dying from starvation, These men, too, are left behind. In this way, Lee's army dwindles. The 30,000 who retreated from Petersburg just 3 days ago have been reduced by half. As the long night march takes a greater toll, even those hardy men stagger like drunks, and some lose the power of speech. And yet, when it comes time to fight, they will find a way to lift their rifle to their shoulder, aim at their target, and squeeze the trigger. "My shoes are gone," a veteran soldier laments during the march. "My clothes are almost gone. I'm weary, I'm sick, I'm hungry. My family has been killed or scattered, and may be wandering helpless and unprotected. I would die, yes, I would die willingly, because I love my country. But if this war is ever over, I'll be damned if I ever love another country." His is the voice of a South that wants no part of Lincoln and the United States of America, and for whom there can be no country but the Confederacy. Just as the Union officer in Richmond spoke of the barbarous South, so these soldiers and men like John Wilkes Booth view the North as an evil empire. This is the divisiveness Lincoln will face if he manages to win the war. Now in the darkness after midnight, a courier approaches the marching soldiers and hands Lee a captured Union message from Grant to his generals, giving orders to attack at first light. But at last, Lee gets good news in the form of a report from his commissary general, I.M. St. John. 80,000 rations have been rushed to the town of Farmville, just 19 miles away. Lee can be there in a day. He swings his army toward Farmville. It is Lee's final chance to keep the Confederate struggle alive. Chapter 9, Wednesday, April 5th, 1865, Jetersville, Virginia. Nighttime. General Sam Grant is also on a midnight ride. The great hooves of his horse beat a tattoo on the bad roads and forest trails of central Virginia. Speed is of the essence. Scouts report that Lee is escaping, marching his men through the night in a bold attempt to reach rations at Farmville. From there, it's just a short march to High Bridge, a stone and wood structure wide enough to handle an army. Once Lee crosses and burns the bridge behind him, his escape will be complete, and the dreadful war will continue. Tonight decides everything. Grant is so close to stopping Lee, so very close. Grant digs his spurs into his horse named Jeff Davis, after the Confederate president, in a gesture uncharacteristically vindictive of Grant, who is usually polite and respectful even to his enemies. Grant knows that he must ride hard. Lee must be captured now, and Grant must capture him personally. As always, his battle plan is simple. Get in front of Lee, block his path. How many times has he explained this to General Sheridan and Meade? Block Lee's path. Stop him in his tracks. Then attack and crush the Army of Northern Virginia. So how is it that Lee came within spitting distance of the Jetersville roadblock and escaped? It confounds Grant that his top generals are so terrified of Lee, holding back when they should rush in. The Union soldiers are better armed, better fed, and far more rested than Lee's men. The generals must be relentless, pressing forward without ceasing until the war is won. But they are not relentless. So it is up to Grant to lead the way. The culprit, Grant decides, is not General Phil Sheridan. He and his cavalry are more than doing their part, charging far and wide over the Virginia countryside, harassing Lee's wagons and skirmishing with Confederate cavalry. Sheridan is Grant's eyes and ears, sending scouts to track Lee's movements and ensuring that Morris Robert doesn't disappear into the Blue Ridge Mountains. Grant would be lost without Sheridan. The same cannot be said of General George Meade. His force reached Jetersville at dusk on April 5th after a dreary day of pursuit. But rather than launch an immediate assault on Lee's rear, as Grant ordered, Meade halted for the night, claiming that his men were too tired to fight. Grant knows there's more to it than that. The problem in a nutshell is that the unspoken rivalry between infantry and cavalry, between the unglamorous and the swashbuckling. Meade's refusal to fight is his way of pouting about the cavalry divisions sharing the roads with his men, slowing their march. Behold the whole of Merritt's division of cavalry filing in from a side road and completely closing the way, one of Meade's aides rode home. That's the way it is with these cavalry bucks. They bother and howl about infantry not being up to support them, and they are precisely the people who are always blocking the way. They are arrant boasters. To hear Sheridan's staff talk, you would suppose 10,000 mounted carbineers had crushed the entire rebellion. The plain truth is they are useful and energetic fellows, but commit the error of thinking they can do everything and that no one else does anything. So Meade made his point by refusing to attack. Sheridan was furious. "I wish you were here," he wired Grant. "We can capture the Army of Northern Virginia if enough force be thrown to this point." Grant reads between the lines. Rather than wait until morning and the chance that Meade will find another excuse for not fighting, he orders his staff to mount up for the 60-mile midnight ride to Jetersville. Never mind its cold, pitch-black night. There is purpose in the journey. They travel carefully lest they surprise Union troops and be mistakenly shot as Southern scouts. Grant is always one to keep his emotions in check, but as he guides his horse from the village of Nottoway Courthouse to Jetersville, from the sandy soils west of Petersburg to the quartz and red soil of the Blue Ridge foothills, Grant fears that Lee is on the verge of outfoxing him again. Grant knows the Confederates are beatable. His spies captured a note from one of Lee's aides detailing the poor morale and horrible conditions the Confederates are experiencing. Grant is also aware of the massive desertions. He has heard about the roads littered with rifles and bedrolls, abandoned wagons and broken horses. He knows that an astronomic number of Confederate men have been taken prisoner. But all of this means nothing if he cannot get ahead of Lee and block the Confederate escape to the Carolinas. And not just that, he must win what he calls the life and death struggle for Lee to get south to his provisions. Once a second-rate fighting force, the Union soldiers have gained remarkable strength since the assault on Petersburg. Nothing seemed to fatigue them, Grant marvels. They were ready to move on without rations and travel without rest until the end. Unlike Lee's bedraggled force, Grant's men march with a bounce in their step. Bands play, nobody straggles or falls out of ranks. They walk the unheard-of distance of 30 miles in one day. Now Grant and the cavalry detail that guards his life walk their horses through a forest to Sheridan's camp. Sentries cry out, ordering them to stop. Grant steps forward to show himself. Within seconds, the sentries allow him to pass and usher Grant to Sheridan's headquarters. Grant speaks briefly with Little Phil, the short and fiery dynamo who makes no secret that he wants his cavalry to be there at the death of the Confederate insurrection. Then the two men saddle up and ride through the darkness to Meade's headquarters in Jetersville. The lanky Pennsylvanian is in bed with what he claims to be a fever. Grant chalks it up to fear and orders Meade to get his army ready to attack. Meade was a hero of Gettysburg, outwitting Lee on the battlefield despite having a reputation for being timid and temperamental. At age 49, the old snapping turtle is the oldest and most experienced man in the room. Grant bears him a grudging respect, but respect isn't enough right now. Grant needs a man who will press the attack day and night, fresh or exhausted, ill or in good health. Meade is not that man. He never has been. Furthermore, it is not merely a question of heart anymore, but of logistics. It is simply impossible for Meade's infantry to outrace Lee to Farmville. Marsh Robert had a good head start, and Meade's halt for the night only increased the distance. Grant now thinks of Lee somewhere out there in the darkness, sitting tall astride Traveler, not letting his men stop their all-night march for any reason. Lee's cavalry, artillery, and infantry at his disposal should have come to a fight. It will take a fast and mobile fighting force to beat the rebels. In other words, Sheridan's cavalry. Grant delivers his orders. "There will be no more waiting," he decrees, proposing a pincer movement. Sheridan in front, Meade from the rear. At first light, Meade's infantry will chase and find Lee's army, then harass them and slow their forward movement. Sheridan, meantime, will put himself south of the enemy and follow him to his death. In this way, the Confederate race to North Carolina will be stopped dead in its tracks. As Sheridan revels in the glory to come, Meade bites his tongue and accepts Grant's decision. He has to. There's nothing more Sam Grant can do. His midnight ride has produced exactly the results he was hoping for. Promptly at 6 a.m., the earth shakes with the clip-clop of thousands of hooves as Sheridan's cavalry trot west in their quest to get in front of Lee. Meade's army, meantime, marches north to get behind Lee, the two armies forming Grant's lethal pincers. Meade's men march past Grant as he sits down at sunrise, lighting a cigar. Grant is confident. Finally, the Black Thursday of the Confederacy has arrived. Chapter 10, Thursday, April 6, 1865, Rice's Station, Virginia, dawn. General Robert E. Lee has been up all night, yet still looks crisp and composed as he rides, backlit by the rising sun, into Rice's Station. The Army of Northern Virginia, looking for all the world like the most beaten-down fighting force in history, cheers as the beloved general glides past on Traveler. Mars Robert is stately and rugged, 6 foot tall, afraid of no man. He is almost asleep in the saddle, thanks to the all-night march. But his broad gray hat remains firmly in place as he acknowledges the adulation of his suffering men. Many don't have shoes. Those that do can put two fingers through the rotting leather soles. Half of Lee's forces quit the war between Petersburg and this tiny depot, slinking into the woods to search for the slightest morsel of a meal, and then not coming back. Those who remain are so crazed from lack of sleep and belly-hollowing hunger that their cheers resemble frantic, drunken slurs. Many are too weak to even shoulder a musket, but Lee knows that somehow they will fight when called to do so. The roads of central Virginia are now littered with the detritus of Lee's retreating army. Guns, blankets, broken wagons, artillery limbers, dead horses, and dead men. It has now been 4 days since the Confederate Army began retreating from Petersburg. The soldiers have endured the betrayal at Amelia Courthouse, where boxcars full of food had been stolen by Confederate scavengers. Still, Lee's men marched on, nerves frazzled by the threat of Union attack, but never stopping for more than 5 or 10 minutes to sleep in the mud before resuming their march. The general understands their suffering. Still, he orders them on. Now they see that he was right all along, for the Army of Northern Virginia has eluded the army of General Ulysses S. Grant. Better yet, there are rations waiting just a few miles away in Farmville. Which is why Lee's crazed soldiers cheer him on this dawn as they march into Rice's Station. Lee is all they believe in right now. Not Confederate President Jefferson Davis, not the Army of Northern Virginia, not even terms like states' rights or pro-slavery, which spurred many men to enlist in the Confederate cause. Now, those things mean nothing. Only Mars Robert matters. They would follow him into hell. Ahead of General Lee is his trusted point man, General Pete Longstreet. Behind Lee is a rear guard under the command of General John P. Gordon, the fearless Georgian. In between is a 10-mile-long supply column supervised by General Richard Fighting Dick Anderson and General Richard Ewell, a veteran soldier with just one leg, who oversees a scrappy band of bureaucrats, frontline veterans, and landlocked sailors who escaped from Richmond just days earlier. The tiny hamlet of Rice's Station is a crossroads. One way leads to the Carolinas and safety. The other direction leads back to Petersburg. Longstreet orders cannons pointed down toward the Petersburg Rose to scare off any Union force that might be stalking them. The tired men dig trenches and earthworks to protect themselves from bullets. The woods serve as latrines, the newly dug trenches as beds. Longstreet's mandate is to remain in Rice's Station until Lee's entire army has passed through. Only then will he and his men evacuate. Incredibly, a bleary-eyed Robert E. Lee is reveling in the moment. The air is fresh, scrubbed clean by the night's rain. Birds are singing to greet this fine spring morning. He knows that Farmville is less than an hour away, with its boxcars filled with smoked meat, cornmeal, and all the makings of a great military feast. Advanced scouts have confirmed that the food is actually there this time. Looters have not touched it. The plan is for Lee's men to fill their empty bellies in Farmville this morning, then march over the great span known as High Bridge, which towers over the Appomattox River, separating central and western Virginia. Lee will order the bridge burned immediately after they cross, preventing the Union force from following. The Carolinas will be reached in days. Lee's escape is so close. But then grim news arrives. A flying column of Union cavalry galloped through Rice an hour ago. They are now ahead of the Confederates. Longstreet scouts report that 800 bluecoats on foot and on horseback are headed for High Bridge. Their goal, obviously, is to burn the bridge and close Lee's escape route. General Lee quickly ponders Longstreet's information. He knows he has no way of stopping the Union advance. For one of the few times in his adult life, Robert E. Lee is stymied. Lee hears the thunder of approaching hooves. General Thomas Lafayette Rosser, a gregarious 28-year-old Texan, gallops his cavalry into Rice's Station. Rosser's roommate at West Point was the equally audacious George Armstrong Custer, now a Union general involved on the other side of this very fight. Longstreet approaches Rosser and, warning him about the Union plan, screams, "Go after the bridge burners. Capture or destroy the detachment, even if it takes the last man of your command to do it." Rosser salutes, his face stolid. Only afterward does he grin, then bark the order. His cavalry, enlisted men and officers alike, gallop toward High Bridge. The quiet morning air explodes with noise as hundreds of hooves pound into the narrow dirt road. When the war first broke out, Thomas Lafayette Rosser was so eager to take up arms for the Confederacy that he dropped out of West Point 2 weeks before graduation. Starting as a lieutenant, he distinguished himself at more than a dozen key battles, among them Manassas, Bull Run, and Gettysburg. Though wounded several times, Rosser never altered his daring approach to combat. In January 1865, as the Army of Northern Virginia huddled in its Petersburg defenses, Rosser selected 300 of his toughest riders for an impossible mission. They crossed the Allegheny Mountains in the dead of winter, seeking to destroy the Union infantry headquartered in the town of Beverly, West Virginia. Thunderstorms drenched them their second day on the march. Then the temperature plummeted below zero, freezing their overcoats stiff. But those hardships actually helped Rosser, making the attack a complete surprise. The daring nighttime raid yielded 800 Union prisoners. So Longstreet knows that Rosser is the sort of man who will not be afraid of the kill or be killed order. Rosser will not let him down. After Rosser departs, there is nothing to do but wait, as Longstreet directs his men to strengthen their impromptu defenses in Rice's Station. Lee can only wonder how long it will take the rest of his army and its wagon train to catch up. With every passing second, the danger of Grant's scouts finding his army grows. Lee cannot let this happen. He must get over High Bridge by the end of the day. Overcome with exhaustion, at last the 58-year-old general instructs his orderly to find some place for him to nap. It is mid-morning. Lee will close his eyes just long enough to feel rejuvenated. Then he will begin perhaps his last campaign. If he doesn't get over High Bridge, Lee knows he will be defeated.
Chapter 11, Thursday, April 6, 1865, Farmville, Virginia, mid-morning. The Union force racing to burn High Bridge consists of the 4th Massachusetts Cavalry, the 54th Pennsylvania Infantry, and the 123rd Ohio Infantry. The cavalry comprised 79 soldiers on horseback who can fight either in the saddle or as dismounted foot soldiers. The 2 infantry regiments comprise almost 800 fighters who can wage war only on foot. If the entire Union force were cavalry, the fearless General Rosser and his men would never catch them. A fast-walking soldier, even one on a mission of the utmost military importance, is obviously no match for a cavalry horse. Colonel Francis Washburn of the 4th Massachusetts knows this, which is why he orders his cavalry to gallop ahead of the foot soldiers. His men will burn the bridge while the infantry covers the rear. High Bridge is an engineering marvel, considered by some to be the finest bridge in the world. The architects of the Brooklyn Bridge will steal liberally from its design. And yet High Bridge is situated not in one of the world's great cities, but in a quiet, wooded corner of Virginia. Made of stone and felled trees, it stretches a half mile from the bluff outside Farmville, marking the southern shore of the Appomattox River floodplain, to the Prince Edward Courthouse bluff at the opposite end. 20 125-foot-tall brick columns support the wooden superstructure. That the 2 great armies, at the most pivotal point in their histories, have descended upon High Bridge at the same time is one of those random acts of fate that so often decide a war. As Colonel Washburn and his men ride within 3 miles of High Bridge, they are joined by Union General Theodore Reed, who has undertaken a daring mission to warn Washburn that the Confederates are hot on his trail, and that a small force of rebels, who have been at High Bridge for months, are dug in around the span. Reed has full authority to cancel Washburn's mission if he thinks it's too risky. Washburn and Reed hold a council of war at a hilltop plantation known as Chatham, roughly halfway between Rice's Station and High Bridge. They can see the bridge in the distance, and the 2 earthen forts defending it. There are just a few dozen Confederates dug in at the bridge, but they have a clear field of fire. A direct frontal assault would leave Washburn's men badly battered. Another concern is that the ground between the Chatham Plateau and High Bridge is a swampy morass of small creeks, sand, and hills, taking away any advantage of speed, and adding the very real potential of getting caught in a kill zone. Nevertheless, General Reed orders Washburn to proceed to the bridge. Reed will stay behind with the infantry to cover the cavalry's rear. This is a gamble, and both of these brave officers know it. a gamble with their own lives and those of their men. It is also a gamble that could end the war by sundown. Washburn leads his cavalry toward Highbridge. He has a reputation for recklessness and impatient courage, and shares the commonly held Union belief that the rebels are too demoralized to fight back. He will burn the bridge at any cost. Washburn's cavalry ride for an hour, taking in the countryside as they prepare for battle. But then, seemingly out of nowhere, they are ambushed by a rebel cavalry. It is a scene out of Lexington and Concord, as Confederate sharpshooters take aim. Again and again, and without warning, rebel cavalry charge. Washburn, fearing nothing, gives chase, but it's a clever trap. The rebels drawing the bluecoats in as they link up with the other Confederate force defending the bridge. Suddenly, Confederate artillery rains down on Washburn and his men, putting an instant halt to the Union pursuit. These cannonballs are the slap in the face that Washburn needs, making him realize that the rebels are hardly too demoralized to fight back. He also knows this. Colonel Francis Washburn of the 4th Massachusetts is right now the one man in America who can end the Civil War this very day. He will go down in history. All he has to do is burn High Bridge. Washburn is within a quarter mile of the bridge, his force largely intact. But then comes the crackle of gunfire from behind him. 3 years of combat experience tells Washburn that he is in deep trouble. Confederate cavalrymen have found his infantry. High Bridge must wait. The 4th Massachusetts has been in the saddle since 4 a.m. It is now almost noon. The men are exhausted, as are their horses. The soldiers gallop their weary animals back across the floodplain, over the Sandy River, and up onto the Chatham Plateau. Men and horses are breathless from the race and the midday heat. The riders' blue uniforms and gloved hands bathed in sweat. Their stomachs rumble from lack of food, and their lips are chapped from thirst. They expect only a minor battle because the main Confederate force is still miles away. But that expectation turns out to be brutally wrong. Some 1,200 Confederate horsemen wait to attack Washburn's cavalry and infantry, which together number just slightly more than 800. Rebel horses and riders hold in a long line, awaiting the inevitable order to charge forth and crush the tiny Union force. Colonel Washburn remains cool, surveying what could be a hopeless situation. Infantry is no match against the speed and agility of cavalry. His infantry lie on their bellies and peer across at Confederate cavalry. They have had no time to dig trenches or build fortifications, so hugging the ground is their only defense. Washburn is cut off from the rest of Grant's army with no hope of rescue. How can 79 Union riders possibly hold off 1,200 Confederate horsemen? Washburn decides that his only hope is to be bold, a quality this Harvard man possesses in abundance. After conferring with General Reed, Washburn orders his cavalry to assemble. They are now on the brow of the hill, just out of rifle range, in columns of four. Washburn addresses the ranks. He barks out his plan, then reminds the infantry to get their butts off the ground and follow right behind the Union riders to punch a hole through the rebel lines. On Washburn's command, the 4th Massachusetts trot their mounts forward. While the Confederates purchased their own horses or brought them from home, the Union horses are government issue. Each trooper has ridden mile upon mile with the same horse in the same saddle. As they arrive at this fateful moment, animal and rider alike know each other's moods and movements, the nudge of a knee, the gathering of the haunch muscles, the forward lean to intimate danger or the need for speed. And so they work as one. Passing the infantry's far right flank, Washburn's cavalry wheels left. The colonel's accent is Brahmin and his tone is fearless. The precision of his cavalry is something that Washburn takes for granted, for they have practiced time and again on the parade ground. And the show of force stuns the enemy. The Confederates see what is coming even if they don't believe it. Counting Reed and Washburn, there are now 80 Union horsemen. Outnumbered by more than 15-1, they shut out all thoughts of this being the last battle of their young lives. They ride hard. Their fate comes down to one simple word: charge. Washburn screams the command. Spurs dig into horses. Sabers clank as they are withdrawn from their sheaths. Some men fire their Spencer carbines as they gallop within rifle range, clutching the gun in their right hand and the reins in their left. Others wield pistols. Still others prefer the killing blade of the cavalry sword. The audacity of their charge and succeed-at-all-cost desperation ignites panic in the rebel army. The battlefield splits in two as Washburn's men punch through the first wave of the rebel line. The Union charge at Chatham, for a brief instant, is a triumph. But stunningly, after the cavalry charges, Washburn's infantry does not move, not a muscle. Even as the Confederate defenses crumble, and as Washburn organizes his men for a secondary attack that will smash an escape route through the rebel lines, the foot soldiers are still on their bellies, sealing their own doom. General Rosser senses exactly what's happening. He doesn't waste a second. The Texan yells for his Confederate cavalry to prepare for a counterattack. The Confederate General James Gearing, just 24 years old, leads the way. Both sides race toward each other at top speed before pulling back on the reins in the center of the plain. The fight becomes a brutal test of courage and horsemanship. Men and horses wheel around the battlefield, fighting hand to hand, saddle to saddle. Each man wages his own individual battle with a ferocity only a life and death situation can bring. Bullets pierce eyes. Screams and curses fill the air. The grassy plain runs blood red. A rifle is too unwieldy in such tight quarters, so men use the butt end rather than the barrel. Pistols and sabers are even more lethal. I have been many a day in hot fights, the unflappable Rosser will marvel later, but I never saw anything approaching that at High Bridge. Rosser's gaze drifts over the amazing sight of his enemy. Washburn, in the thick of the action, is a frenzied dervish, slaying everything in his path. Men fall and die all around as Washburn rides tall in the saddle, his saber slashing at any man who steps forward to challenge him. Suddenly, the young Confederate General Deering shoots the Union General Theodore Reed at point-blank pistol range. Reed falls from his saddle to the ground. Seeing this, Colonel Washburn takes his revenge. He engages Deering in an intense saber duel, brought to a sudden end when a Union soldier fires two bullets into Deering's chest. His sword falls to the ground, as does he. Washburn is still sitting tall in the saddle, but not for long. As he turns his head, he is shot through the mouth at point-blank range. The bullet lodges in his lungs. His jaw hangs slack as blood pours from the hole in his face down onto his sweaty, dusty blue uniform. The force of the gunshot does not kill Washburn, nor even render him unconscious. It is, however, strong enough to knock him out of the saddle for the first time all day. As the colonel falls, a Confederate flails at his toppling body with a 34-inch saber, burying the blade deep into Washburn's skull. Incredibly, one day later, as a burial detail cleans the battlefield, Washburn will be found alive. There are many, many casualties. The Confederates lose 100 men. The Union loses every man. Every single one of the 847 Union soldiers sent to burn High Bridge is either captured or killed. Those who try to fight their way out are slaughtered one by one. The failure of the Union infantry to obey Washburn's orders to attack sealed their fate. Rosser leads his weary men back towards Rice's Station, content in the knowledge that he has single-handedly saved the Confederacy. Lee will now have his escape, or at least it appears that way. Chapter 12, Thursday, April 6th, 1865. On the road to Farmville, Virginia, afternoon. As the battle for High Bridge commences, Union General George Meade's infantry finally finds the tail end of the Confederate column about 10 miles away from the High Bridge fight. A hard rain falls. In the first of what will be many firefights on this day, small bands of Union soldiers begin shooting at the Confederate rear guard. The movement is like a ballet, with skirmishers pushing forward through the trees and craggy ground to engage the rebels. The instant they run out of ammunition, these skirmishers pull back, and another group races forward to take their place. And all the while, other infantrymen capture artillery pieces, burn wagons, and force the rebels to turn and fight, and sometimes even dig in, separating them further from Lee's main force. Confederate General John Gordon's force falls behind first. The ferocious Georgian understands that he is being cut off. In fact, Lee's entire Confederate army is being separated. No longer is it a single force. It has been broken into four separate corps. Under normal conditions, the cavalry would plug these gaps or, at the very least, chase away the Union skirmishers. But the cavalry have their hands full at High Bridge. Meantime, in Rice Station, Lee rises from his nap and assesses the situation. Hearing the ferocity of the firing from Highbridge, he assumes that the Union force is much bigger than the 800 men who galloped past him a few hours ago. If Lee had any cavalry at his disposal, they would act as his eyes and ears, scouting ahead and returning with the truth. But he doesn't. Lee can only guess at what's happening, and he guesses wrong. Fearing that the Union General Sheridan has already leapfrogged out in front, Lee holds his entire corps in Rice's Station. At a time when it is crucial to be on the move, General Lee chooses to remain in place. As Lee waits, Sheridan's three divisions of cavalry are searching high and low for the Army of Northern Virginia. His three commanders are Generals George Armstrong Custer, Thomas Devon, and George Crook. Custer is the youngest and most aggressive, the blonde-haired dynamo who roomed with Thomas Rosser at West Point. Custer has a flair for the dramatic. He is the sort of man who rides into battle wearing a flamboyant red kerchief around his neck and accompanied by a brass band. That kind of display will make George Custer famous. 11 years later, it will also kill him. As Sheridan holds back two-plot strategy, it is Custer who leads the Union cavalry on their search-and-destroy mission against the Confederate column. At mid-morning, he discovers the heart of the column, perhaps 6 miles from Highbridge. Custer does not hesitate. His division attacks. But upon meeting resistance, the young general stalls, allowing another cavalry division to attack. In this way, Custer slowly works his way up the Confederate line, riding closer and closer to the very front, towards Sam Grant's objective of getting out in front of Lee. The pace is cruel. By noon, Custer's horses are thirsty and in need of rest. They stop at a small stream. Custer's aide approaches, bringing news that the scouts have found a gap in the Confederate line. Now, Custer sets aside all thoughts of getting out in front of Lee. He excitedly gives the command to mount up. Without waiting for the other two divisions, a habit that will seal his doom at the Little Bighorn, his cavalry race toward the gap, hoping to drive a permanent wedge between the Confederate divisions. Custer succeeds. By 2 p.m., Custer's division pours into the small town of Marshall's Crossroads, where they are met by a lone artillery battalion. The Confederate cannons are no match for Custer's horsemen. He captures the small force and sets the rebel guns ablaze. But then another Confederate force counterattacks, pushing Custer out of the town. The Confederates dig in immediately, knowing that more fighting is imminent. The rebels hope to hold on long enough for Lee's main army to reinforce them. George Custer, however, is not to be denied. He dismounts his men and orders them to assume an infantry posture. Then he scribbles a message to Crook and Devon, requesting help. Within an hour, their divisions are on the scene. All afternoon, the three Union divisions initiate mounted and dismounted cavalry charges against the dug-in rebels. In the absence of artillery, the Bluecoats boldly ride their horses up and over the Confederate breastworks. The Confederates cower in their trenches to avoid being trampled to death. The alternative is to run. Those who do are chased and cut down with sabers. Even so, the rebels hold fast, repelling each and every charge. The general in charge, Fighting Dick Anderson, is a brilliant tactician, placing his limited resources in just the right place to repel the cavalry. Finally, as daylight turns to evening, Custer assembles his men for one final charge. He orders the regimental band to play, hoping to strike fear in the enemy. Seeing the assembled cavalry, Confederate officers call an immediate retreat. Their goal is to reach Lee at Rice's Station. Custer and the Union cavalry ride fast and hard into Anderson's lines before they can retreat. By now, Sheridan has sent word saying go right through them. They're demoralized as hell, an order that the Union cavalry take to heart. Anderson's Confederate corps breaks, the men dropping their weapons and running for their lives. Of about 3,000 rebels, only 600 escape Custer. But the general is still not satisfied. He orders three Union cavalry divisions to give chase, cutting men down as they run. In a rare act of lenience, those who make it into the woods are allowed to live. Later, they will be rounded up as prisoners of war. For now, their confinement is the woods itself. Those who try to fight their way out are promptly driven back inside. More than 2,600 Confederates are captured, among them the one-legged General Richard Ewell. As he surrenders to Custer, he knows that a portion of his men are trapped on a grassy hillside a few miles up the road above a swollen stream known as Sailor's Creek. These men are spoiling for another fight, a battle that will go down as one of the most barbaric and ferocious of the entire war. General George Custer has seen much ferocious fighting in his young life, but he has never seen anything like Sailor's Creek. Chapter 13, Thursday, April 6, 1865, Sailor's Creek, late afternoon. In 1865, the Sailor's Creek area of central Virginia is a place of outstanding beauty. Verdant rolling hills compete with virgin forest to present a countryside that is uniquely American, a place where families can grow amid the splendors of nature. But the beauty of the area will soon be defiled by the ugliness of war. Grant's Union Army has finally arrived to confront Lee's forces. Lee's men are tired and hungry. Many have fought the North from the beginning, seeing action at Manassas, at Fredericksburg, and at Gettysburg. One group in particular, the Stonewall Brigade, marched into battle under Stonewall Jackson, who, next to Lee, was the greatest of all Southern generals. These same hardened fighters wept tears of grief when Jackson fell from his horse, the victim of friendly fire. Years of battle have reduced the numbers of the Stonewall Brigade from 6,000 soldiers to just a few hundred battle-tested veterans. These men know the meaning of war. They also know the meaning, if not the precise military definition, of terms like enfilade and field of fire and reverse slope defense, for they can execute them in their sleep. The Stonewall Brigade and the rest of Lee's men, depleted as they are practiced experts at warfare. Lee knows that his fighting force is splintered. Near a bucolic estate called Lockett's Farm, the Jamestown Road crosses over Big Sailor's Creek and Little Sailor's Creek at a place called Double Bridges. There are, as the name implies, two narrow bridges. The wagons must all funnel into a narrow line and cross one at a time. Lee is miles away from his supply train and cannot protect it. His only hope is that the Union Army will be too slow in catching up to the wagons. Grant's army is now in sight. The soldiers' blue uniforms and the glint of their steel bayonets strike fear into the hearts of the Teamsters, causing the wagons to attempt to cross double bridges two and three at a time. Wheels become tangled. Horses and mules balk in their traces, confused by the noise and smelling the panic. Their pace grows slower and slower until one of the bridges actually collapses from the weight, and the Confederate advance comes to an abrupt halt. Within minutes, the Union attacks. Sweeping down from the high ground, General Meade's infantry pounces on the terrified Confederates, who abandon their wagons and race into the woods on foot. The Confederate infantry waits a few hundred yards ahead of the chaos, watching. They stand shoulder to shoulder, their line of battle almost 2 miles wide. Thus are 4,000 of Lee's troops poised to meet the Union attack. Behind them, rebel wagons are burning on the double bridges above Sailor's Creek. To the left of the Confederate force is the Appomattox River. Straight in front of them are thousands of advancing blue-clad Yankees. At first, the Confederate infantry line holds, but under withering artillery fire, the men begin to fall back. It is a mile-long retreat over open ground that offers almost no cover. The rebel infantry topple the wagons that have made it across the double bridges, using them as an impromptu breastworks, hiding behind a spoked wheel or a tilted axle. The sun cannot set quickly enough for these men. With 10,000 Union troops almost on top of them, darkness is the rebels' only hope. Night does not come soon enough, and the fight begins. Almost immediately, the Confederates take incredible losses. Artillery and bullets level any man who dares to stand still. Many soldiers quit the war right then and there, convinced that this endless wave of blue is unbeatable. They see the wagons afire and hear the explosions of the ammunition inside, and know in an instant that of the three things a soldier needs to survive in wartime, bullets, sleep, and food, they have none. Others, however, are more game. They abandon the cover of the wagons and begin to splash across Sailor's Creek. They are rewarded. Just as the North surges forward, hope arrives. It comes in the form of Robert E. Lee, who has spent the afternoon on horseback trying to find his own army. He sits astride Traveler, looking down from a nearby ridgeline. The disaster which had overtaken the army was in full view. One of his officers will later write, "Teamsters with their teams and dangling traces, retreating infantry without guns, many without hats, a harmless mob, with massive columns of the enemy moving orderly on." This harmless mob, Lee realizes, is his own army of Northern Virginia. "My God," says a horrified Lee, staring down at the columns of smoke and tongues of flames and stacks of bodies, "so many that the ground along both branches of Sailor's Creek is a carpet of gray and blue. Has the army been dissolved? 2 miles south of Lee's viewpoint, and a half mile north of where General Custer still has a Confederate force pinned down, perhaps the most ferocious battle ever seen on American soil is unfolding. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, one Confederate soldier will remember, we reached Sailor's Creek, a small creek that at the time had overflowed its banks from the continuous rains of the past few days, giving the appearance of a small river. We halted a few minutes, then waded across the stream and took our positions on the rising ground 100 yards beyond. The hill is grassy, but the site of the Confederate stand is toward the back of the rise, under the cover of broom sedge and pine shrubs. Now the rebels hold the high ground. Any force attacking Lee's army of almost 4,000 will have to expose themselves to fire while wading the 4-foot-deep morass of Sailor's Creek. If they get across safely, they will then have to fight their way uphill to the rebel positions. We threw ourselves prone upon the ground. Our battle line was long drawn out, exceedingly thin. Here we rested, awaiting the attack, as the enemy had been following closely behind us, a Confederate major will later chronicle. At 5:30, the Union artillery opens fire on the grassy hill, lobbing shells at the Confederate positions from just 400 yards away. The rebels have no artillery of their own and cannot fire back. The screams of the wounded are soon drowned out by the whistle and explosion of shells. All the Confederates can do is hug the ground and pray as the Union gunners take their artillery practice without let or hindrance. The shelling lasts 20 minutes. Under cover of that heavy fire, long blue lines of Union infantry wade the creek, separate into two battle lines, and slowly march up the hill. The Confederates are devastated by the precision artillery, but do not retreat. Instead, they lie flat on the ground, muskets pointed at the stream of blue uniforms, picking their way up the grassy slope. A Confederate major steps boldly in front of the line and walks the entire length, exposing himself to fire as he reminds the rebels that no one is allowed to shoot until ordered to do so. He later recalls the instruction that when I said ready, they all must rise, kneeling on the right knee. That when I said aim, they must all aim above the knees of the advancing line, and that when I said fire, they must all fire together. Everything, as one officer notes, is as still as the grave. The advancing line of blue moves forward in a giant scrum, slowly ascending the hill. Some of the men wave white handkerchiefs, mocking the Confederates, jeering that they should surrender. But the rebels say nothing, letting the Union soldiers believe the South is already beaten. The bluecoats refrain from charging, preferring to plod, letting the notion of surrender sink in, for the rebels surely know there is no way they can get off this hill alive. Ready, comes the cry from the Confederate lines. They are low on ammunition and may only get one shot or two. Even then, reloading a musket takes time. Better to make each shot count. The men rose all together like a piece of mechanism, kneeling on their right knees, and their faces set with an expression that meant everything, a Confederate officer will write. On the cry of aim, a line of horizontal muskets points directly at the blue wall. Then, fire. I have never seen such an effect, physical and moral, produced by the utterance of one word, marvels the Confederate major. The enemy seemed to have been totally unprepared for it. The entire